This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to part two of the Cassini Charm Anniversary Telecon. Today we'll be hearing from experts and scientists who work on the Cassini project talking about Saturn's largest moon, Titan. All the other moons, and I'm laughing because I'm very much a Titan person, and also about the rings, which I guess is taking the number of very small things orbiting around Saturn to its logical conclusion. We're going to be starting off the first of our three talks with Dr. Zibby Turtle. Zibby is a Cassini Imaging Science System Team Associate and Cassini Radar Team Associate, who's based at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. She received her PhD in planetary science from the University of Arizona in 1998. Dr. Turtle's been involved with other interplanetary imaging systems as well. She was a team associate with the Galileo Solid State Imaging Instrument, which targeted Jupiter, in addition to being a co-investigator for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera. She will be returning to Jupiter in spirit as the principal investigator for the Europa Imaging System on NASA's Europa mission. Zibby, it's all yours.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be talking to everyone about Titan again after our 11th, well, on our, well, I guess after our 11th anniversary. It's been a busy and exciting year, and I'm going to go over some of the highlights of the observations as well as some of the science results that have been published. Some of those are about previous observations, but newly published results. So I'm going to go ahead and get started, and we'll walk through what we've learned about Titan in the last year, if my computer lets me advance. Interesting. Okay. This is a summary of the Cassini mission, and we're getting farther and farther to the right in this graph, which is exciting and also a little sad as we start finding more and more last events. But like I said, it's been a very exciting year for Titan science. And this slide shows the graphics for the flybys that have occurred over the last year. These are really fun graphics, kind of highlighting some of the primary science from each of the flyby, and it's great that these get made for each. And then in the middle, I've just listed the dates of all the flybys from July 2014 through July 2015. This past January was the 10th anniversary of the Huygens landing on Titan. So there were a lot of events associated with that. Going back and kind of thinking about all the things we've learned about Titan since we landed in early 2005. At that point in time, we'd only had a couple of Titan flybys, and we're still really trying to understand what the surface looked like, what it looked like meant. It was still hard to interpret some of the surface features that we were seeing in the radar and the near IR imaging, because Titan doesn't, in some places, look like what we would expect of an icy satellite, because it's such a different environment. And it was just spectacular as the Huygens probe images started coming back to look at a landscape that was so suddenly familiar, looking at the images of the channel networks. And we could look at this and know exactly what it is, as opposed to having been puzzling over the radar images and what the cat scratches were for the previous month. So it was great to get to think back and look over how much we'd learned about Titan in the ensuing time. This is a list that was released with the events for the anniversary of the different of the top 10 things that we'd been learning about Titan over the past 10 years. And I included a couple of links in the presentation. Joe, are the presentations made available to everyone? I know they used to be posted somewhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't right now.
Okay.
However, we are going to be recording this entire thing on WebEx, and so an audio and a visual record of it will be available for download hopefully within the next couple of weeks.
Okay, great. And if you go to the JPL website for Cassini or the ESA website for Huygens, you can find the links to these movies. But there are a number of movies that were released at the anniversary, and they're pretty fun to look at how all the data has been combined into those movies. So getting to the last year's discoveries and observations of Titan. This is an observation of Titan's high northern latitudes that was taken on the 21st of August. So this is just over a year ago. The Titan anniversary presentation at CHARM was given last year between when we had the ISS data, which revealed this cloud feature, and we had this great sequence of watching that cloud evolve. And so that was presented in the CHARM telecon last year, but the VIMS data hadn't been analyzed and processed yet. So this kind of brackets that time frame. In addition to that, that cloud feature that we got to watch evolve over Lygia Mare, the VIMS data show this exceedingly bright specular reflection here. And this is on the this is a reflection from the surface of Kraken Mare, just between Kraken Mare is kind of separated into two parts, and this is just near the archipelago, right where those are separated. These specular reflections are really important for understanding where the liquid distribution on Titan, and I've got another result that I'll mention in a few slides. That's really helping us to understand the liquids on Titan, how they're distributed, and how they may be behaving. Another thing that shows up in this is that you can see around Kraken Mare there's this kind of pinkish or orangish in this false color view of the VIMS data rim, which is suggestive of evaporites. You can see there these similar bright materials elsewhere in high northern latitudes, and that's been seen before, but it really stands out around the rim of Kraken in this observation, and that suggests that there's been evaporation right at the edge, and that Kraken might have had larger boundary in the past. This is a very busy flyby. We had the ISS observations of the evolution of the clouds over Lygia. The VIMS data, a spectacular view of the high northern latitudes, and there were radar observations as well. And the radar observations allowed us to look again at an area of Kraken. This is actually Lygia, where in April 2006 we'd seen the shoreline next to the sea is the very dark here. We'd seen the shoreline, and then in July 2013, there'd been a feature in the sea, and it's this has been analyzed a lot by the radar team, and it's not an artifact. It's a real feature of some sort, and we got to look at this area again in just over a year ago, and lo and behold, it wasn't there again. These have been kind of dubbed magic islands by the team because they seem to kind of appear and disappear. They're still looking at possible explanations, but those include waves on the surface because the radar is sensitive to the roughness of the surface. So if there were waves, then that would roughen the surface of the sea, and that might appear this way to the radar. It's also possible that the surface is disturbed by material, by bubbles rising from the bottom of the sea, or solids that are suspended either right at the surface or just below the surface. And it's possible that there are other explanations as well. One of the things that is harder to explain is that in some places we've seen these multiple times in basically the same place, and why you'd see that, you know, if it's waves, why that would occur in the same place multiple times is a little harder to explain than perhaps some of the other scenarios, like rising bubbles if there's material outgassing at the bottom of the sea. But it's still a bit mysterious. So there's this observation in Lygia. We had a similar observation again in August of last year, where there's a brightening of the sea surface in Kraken Mare in this case. So there are multiple cases where we've seen this, and it is suggestive, as I said, potentially of waves on the surface. We do expect that wind will pick up at high northern latitudes as the summer progresses on Titan. We're moving toward northern summer, and is expected that this that the heating will cause more storms to occur. Same phenomenon we have on Earth in the summer. And that in that case we might get rain and or wind disturbing the surface. So it's possible we're starting to see that pick up. But we've got fortunately some more time to continue to watch Titan and see how things continue to change. On this same flyby again, the radar altimetry mode was used over part of Kraken Mare. This is a kind of a tributary, or the mouth of a river, leading into Kraken Mare, and at a few places along this altimetry track, the depth to the bottom of the river channel was measured. So in each case, it's about 30 meters deep. So that's a fair amount of liquid. But not nearly as much as seen in Lygia, which out in the sea is actually 170 meters deep. For Kraken on this flyby, no signal was detected from the seafloor. So that suggests either that Kraken is too deep for a signal to get to the bottom and then be detected again, which would have to be more than 200 meters. That's consistent with Lygia being 170 meters deep. Kraken is in places broader than Lygia. And Kraken also has very steep shorelines, which would be consistent with a deep seafloor. Another possibility is that it's just that the liquid is more absorbing, that there's slight differences in the liquid. Lygia is seems to be very pure methane. It's possible that Kraken has more ethane, and that might change the absorption as well. So those are some of the scenarios there that are being considered. This is that same area. There's a paper that came out last year with a new process to despeckle. If you look, I'll go back to the radar image. You can see how speckly this looks in the radar return. And there's a new process that Lucas et al. Have developed to clean that up. It removes some of the information as cleaning data tends to do, but it does bring out some of the surface detail from that speckly background. So this is that same area with the channel here leading into Kraken Mare. And there are multiple views that this processing is very intensive, but it has been performed for multiple areas on Titan and really brings out some of the details. Also sticking with the lakes for a little bit longer, or the seas, I should say. So here's a map that the radar team released of the North Pole a little over a year ago. And you can see Lygia Mare here and Kraken. This is that area where Kraken is kind of divided by an archipelago. And so that specular reflection I spoke to in one of the early slides was coming from right about here. And here's Punga Mare, which is one of the other large seas. This is, I think, that area, that river channel that the depth was measured over in the previous slide. So Lygia Mare and Kraken Mare are actually appear to be connected through what's now named Trevis Stratum, which is the word for strait. So it appears that there can actually be liquid transport between the two seas. And we know Lygia has a fairly methane-pure composition because the radar is able to see through to its bottom, and 170 meters of liquid, if it is absorbing, is not easy to see through. The fact that they're connected brings up an interesting possibility that there might be a net transport of solutes like ethane from Lygia into Kraken, and there's been some modeling done to understand how these two bodies of liquid and the connection would behave. And as a result of such transport, Lygia could become fairly pure in methane, but Kraken actually might be more dominated by ethane, which is interesting, especially when you start considering how the seas interact with the atmosphere, because obviously the seas are a source of the liquid that will evaporate into the atmosphere and then perhaps rain out. And so trying to understand how these are such large bodies of liquid, you know, trying to understand how they interact with the atmosphere is they could have quite a significant impact on the atmospheric behavior and the seasonal weather. Interestingly, an observation this winter, and I don't have the image yet, although Christophe Sautin is going to speak about this at a conference this fall, VIMS observed again the specular point over Trevise Freedom last February. So in this area. But the specular reflection didn't come from the specular point. It was offset a little bit. And that suggests surface roughness of the liquid. And that could be surface roughness generated by wind, like waves, the same way we saw potentially for the Magic Islands that the radar has seen. But it's also possible that because this is in Trevise Freedom, it's actually currents. That they're tidal currents. They looked at the location of Titan in its orbit relative to Saturn, which suggested that there could actually be at that time, at that location in its orbit, tidal currents running between the two seas, and that would be enough to generate a surface roughness from the turbulence of the flow back and forth between the seas. So that's particularly interesting, I'll be anxious to see the presentation from Christophe and the presentation of the images that VIMS has of that. It's going to be very interesting. Of course, the seas aren't the only bodies of liquid on Titan. There are also these little cookie cutter lakes that are very intriguing. They're very isolated. They have rounded, steep shorelines. They're set very deep, tens, 100 meters down into the surface, and they don't have little, you know, unlike Kraken and Lygia, you can see how well connected they are to river channels and river networks. But the lakes don't have that. They're not necessarily near channels, and they don't seem to be fed by or flow out through channels. So it's been quite a puzzle to try to understand how these could form. And one hypothesis has been that they are similar to karst terrain on Earth. On Earth, water erodes carbonate and evaporite minerals by dissolution. On Titan, a new study here by Cornet et al. Has looked at whether surface solid organics can dissolve in liquid hydrocarbons. We don't have a really good idea. We know that there's a lot of organic material on the surface of Titan, but we don't know the composition specifically. But they've looked at the erosion rates of organics in methane and ethane, and have found that it could take tens of millions of years to create a 100-meter depression if you assume a fairly rainy area. We think the poles get a fair amount of rain. We observed that at the South Pole in late southern summer back in 2004. But we haven't seen rain yet at the North Pole. But atmospheric models suggest that the poles are rainier, and under those conditions, within a relatively short geologic timescale, meters of the depressions of the depths that have been observed could form. So that's a good indication that maybe this karstic explanation for these lakes is going to work. They really do. If you compare the map of Titan to, say, Florida, where there's a lot of karstic terrain, it looks very similar. So it's good to know that the lab work is consistent with that as well, and that the materials may be behaving consistently. And of course, as we, you know, as Cassini continues to make observations of Titan over the next couple of years, we'll be watching the lakes as well as the seas to look for changes, and just the northern hemisphere in general to look for seasonal changes in the weather patterns. There's still, hopefully, plenty of data yet to come. Also, a seasonal change going back, this is going to the South Pole. Cassini observed a vortex form over the high southern latitudes of Titan as we progress, as it formed in about 2012 as northern fall was advancing. And this is a VIMS observation here, I should say. This is a VIMS observation with some pixels over the polar vortex here. This is an ISS observation of the vortex. Higher resolution, but doesn't have the spectral information. So the VIMS data have been processed so that the Titan surface is showing up in orange in this false color view, and the limb hazes show up as green, and the polar vortex here in blue stands out very, very well. The spectra of the polar vortex reveal hydrogen cyanide frozen as part of the composition of the cloud, if you will, which means that in order for hydrogen cyanide to be frozen, Titan's atmosphere has to have cooled much more rapidly. This is fairly soon in, fairly early in Titan's southern fall. And the atmosphere would need to be about 100 Celsius degrees colder than the predictions for the models, that models had made for the cooling of the atmosphere. So this is a really important data point for understanding the global scale atmospheric behavior and how the seasons change at the poles, which of course is important because those are where the reservoirs of liquid methane are most prominently distributed. So the graphic here illustrates the geometry that occurred during a flyby of Titan. This was a flyby in 2013. This is a paper by Bertucci et al. That just came out this year. And so during this T96 flyby in late 2013, Titan here was actually outside of Saturn's magnetic field. It was known that this was a possibility, that the solar wind can at times be strong enough that it pushes on Saturn's magnetic field, and that Titan's orbit can take it outside of that. Titan is usually and almost always, in Cassini's experience, within the magnetic field. But in this case, it was actually outside of the magnetosphere of Saturn. And that's really interesting. There are a few planets that we can see this for. Earth, of course, is protected by the magnetic field, so our atmosphere doesn't interact with the solar wind directly. On Venus and Mars, they do. The solar wind drapes right around the planet and therefore is impinging directly on the atmospheres. It wasn't known how Titan's atmosphere, because it's got such complex organic chemistry, would interact with the solar wind. But as for Venus and Mars, the interaction created a shockwave right around Titan, where the solar wind impinged onto the atmosphere. So this was a very interesting, and a case that everyone had been wanting to get to observe for quite a while. But in 2013, we finally got to see Titan interacting directly with the solar wind as opposed to protected by the magnetosphere. I mentioned that one of the high priorities is understanding the seasonal changes on Titan. In particular, we've been watching for the summer storms that are supposed to pick up at high northern latitudes any day now. we keep saying this. We keep expecting this. Now, at this point in time, all of the atmospheric models have predicted that that clouds and rainfall should be occurring at high northern latitudes by this point in the year. This is a list here of different events, including the dates of the Voyager 1 and 2 flybys in Titan's year. So Voyager 1 and 2 were in late March and early April. When Cassini got there, it was mid-January, and now we've progressed through a Titanian year since the Voyager flybys. And at that point, we started seeing the changes in the upper atmospheric hazes, the formation of the South Polar Vortex. Today, it is late May on Titan. And as I said, we've been expecting storms to occur at high northern latitudes for quite a while. A year ago, we had a few clouds form over Lygia, and never have so few and small clouds created so much excitement about things yet to come. But since then, Titan has actually been quite sunny. So we're continuing to watch for that, and one of the high priorities for future observations of Titan is to see when these storms start, because that's really important for understanding the atmospheric circulation and the hydrocarbon cycle. We expect that the rain, you know, that the material, the methane will rain out onto the surface, but we haven't seen that happening. And watching changes in the lakes and the seas after a rainstorm will help constrain the hydrology, the subsurface hydrology and connections. So we're very anxious to see that and have some good opportunities coming up in the next couple of years. So hopefully everything will cooperate and we'll get to see some of that. I just wanted to put in a couple of slides showing the next few flybys. The next one is T113 at the end of this month. And each of these just shows the ground track on Titan. So these are all very low latitude flybys. It's a little while now, about a year from now, we start getting back up to high latitude flybys where we really get to see the high northern latitudes in particular, because those are illuminated well. But this is the inbound view for T113, where we get to see Shangri-La again. And actually, we haven't really seen this part of Titan very well since T12, which was back in March 2006. So now we have, it'll be very interesting again to be able to make comparisons see if there have been any changes. We don't necessarily expect any in the dune fields, but it's a good opportunity to look for that. Oh, and I will leave it with this recent image of Titan in front of the rings and little Pandora, and take any questions.
Thanks very much, Vivi. In the room, we're all chuckling about how drought has struck not only California, but also clearly extra Titan.
Ah, yes.
We are so sorry. I saw a number of questions drifting in, and I wanted to know if anybody had any questions for Dr. Sherrill. Well, one of the questions I was asked was, what percentage of the surface of Titan has been imaged so far by ISS? And I was guessing that we're getting up near 90%, but I might be way off.
Yeah, it depends a bit on the resolution that you mean. But we have seen all of the surface at some resolutions. We've seen a little over 90%, I think, at the several kilometer resolution scale. And we've seen 50%, I'm talking about the camera right now, we've seen about 50% at a kind of 1 to 2 kilometer scale. The limiting factor for Titan is the atmosphere, because there's so much atmospheric scattering. So we can't, no matter how close we get to the surface, unless we're down beneath the clouds the way Huygens was, we don't get to see the surface at super high resolution. VIMS does a little, can get higher resolution, but has had less coverage at those resolutions, because it's a, you have to be fairly close for it to be able to get the highest resolutions. The radar, which also images the surface at a scale of half a kilometer to several hundred meters, I think also has covered about 50% of Titan at this point with SAR images. It has a number of other modes as well, and I think there's global coverage with the radiometry and scatterometry. But with the SAR imaging of the surface features, it's about 50% now.
Another question.
What will be the final percentage when the mission's completed?
Oh, I don't. For the cameras, will get a little more. So we'll have global coverage, and there'll be, in most areas, will be covered at least several. We'll have global coverage at several kilometer pixel scale, if not better, with the cameras in the near IR. The radar, I don't know the final number. I'm sorry. It's in the 50s, I think, but I don't know the number.
Again, if I could also, since you mentioned the obscuring clouds, do the clouds have a particular pattern that they're consistent over some spots, or do the cloud patterns move across like what we see on the Earth?
Yeah, so I wasn't very precise in my language there. What obscures the surface for the images, so like the image that's up right now, it's not actually cloudy. This is a perfectly sunny day on Titan. The atmosphere is very hazy because of the hydrocarbon materials in it, the chemistry with the breakdown of methane by the UV light from the sun. So there's a lot of haze in the atmosphere, and that's really what's obscuring the surface. Obviously, when there are clouds, those also obscure the surface, but those are usually smaller and shorter-lived. The haze is always there. And in terms of mapping the surface, it's been great because we haven't had any clouds, so there's been nothing obscuring the surface besides this limiting factor on the resolution from the haze. If we start picking up more clouds at northern latitudes, then that will be a different story. But we'll be able to map the clouds. In terms of predicting them, we're not doing so well so far, because we expected that after having seen clouds in the southern hemisphere, the South Pole, at late southern summer, that we'd start to see clouds at the North Pole in northern summer, and we haven't seen those yet. I don't think we understand the circulation and the cloud forming in Titan's atmosphere as well as we hoped. That being said, one never knows. This could be an anomalous year on Titan. It could be that in most years by now there'd be tons of clouds and tons of rain at the North Pole, and this is just a dry year the same way it's a dry year in California. So we're hoping to get some more data from Titan to understand that better.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, this is Adrian. I'm a solar system ambassador, and I had a question about craters and was wondering if there are any lakes and craters formed by meteors.
There are impact craters on Titan. We haven't seen lakes in the craters. Most of the craters that we've seen actually are at lower latitudes, and they're only a few tens of craters. Because the surface, like Earth's surface, is so heavily eroded, the craters get eroded and buried the same way they do on Earth. So if you compare a picture of the Earth to a picture of the Moon, right, they've been in exactly the same cratering environments, basically, but the Moon is very heavily cratered in most places. And, of course, Earth has impact craters, but only about 150 just because of the resurfacing. And Titan has the same situation as Earth. There's just a lot of resurfacing that's erased the craters. There had been predictions that there might be ring lakes in multi-ring structures or peak ring structures, but we haven't seen any definitive evidence of impact craters that are filled with liquid.
Okay.
There are some filled with dunes, though.
Oh, okay. So that there were never any liquids there at all?
No, I wouldn't say that. The equatorial regions on Titan. So what you can see here, actually, this is the kind of equatorial band, and these dark areas are sand dune seas. But in these areas around those, we do see channels on the surface. So there's clearly been liquid that's flowed on the surface at low latitudes before. In 2010, we even saw a big storm that appeared to rain on the surface at low latitudes. So there clearly have been liquids there before. But like the deserts on Earth, you get rain once in a while. You can get torrential rainfalls that you get flash floods, and they erode channels very quickly. But most of the time, they're dry, and the dune seas suggest the same thing for the sand seas suggest the same things for Titan's low latitudes, that it does rain once in a while, but it's a predominantly arid environment.
Okay. And could you tell us a little bit more about the ISS survey?
The surface mapping?
Yes.
We should actually have a new map that we'll be able to release soon. We've compiled the images. I think the most recent map is something like 2011. So it had been quite a while, and we finally got views of the high northern latitudes a year or two ago. So we've been able to compile those all into a new map, and we'll be releasing that, I hope, in the next month or so. So keep on the lookout for that. There'll still be a couple of gaps in that that we'll be able to fill by the end of the mission with some of the later flybys. But at this point, it is pretty much 90% surface coverage at the several-kilometer scale. So we've got a good global map, and that's really useful for comparing to the VIMS map and the radar, because now we can start doing really good cross-correlations between the different wavelengths, which tell us about the surface materials. So that's been very useful.
Great. Thank you.
Right. I want to thank you again. I think we have time for one quick question, one last one.
I want to ask a question. Hello?
Okay, we have time for one more, and then if people can send them, we'll see if we can get answers, and maybe we'll see about getting things posted on the charm page as a follow-up. So one last question for now, please.
Hello?
Yes?
Hi, this is Deirdre from Ireland. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. My question is about the clouds. Did they form in a similar way to clouds on Earth, you know, coming from the liquid areas and rising up and moving and forming and dropping their rain on the moon?
Yes. In many cases, that's exactly what we've seen. The first clouds that we saw, this was back on the very first distant flyby, so July 2004, there were clouds over the South Pole, and they were just little fields of cumulus convective clouds, just the way I can actually see out my window right now, actually.
Yeah.
And we did, in fact, from a larger outburst of clouds just that fall, see an area of the surface that was darkened from rainfall. So the process for forming the clouds on Titan is very familiar. It's the materials that are different. So instead of water, as on Earth, it's methane.
Does that make the clouds different? Or do they move differently? Because to me, they seem to be heavier materials. I don't know. Maybe they're not.
Well, there's lower gravity, too.
Yes.
The main difference is altitude. Titan's atmosphere is much more extended than Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So the clouds are much higher in the atmosphere as opposed to a few kilometers up there, a few tens of kilometers up.
Mm-hmm.
In general, they're very similar.
And they're called, are you calling them similar, you know, descriptive names like cumulus and altocumulus and altocumulus?
We don't have too many examples that we see at mid latitudes. We've actually seen these elongated streaks, but we don't see them at high enough resolution, spatially or temporally to really understand the dynamics in as much detail as we obviously can on Earth. But there have been studies into the formation and the dynamics of the clouds, and we're hoping that we'll get some more clouds so that we can do more observations and try to understand them better.
Thank you.
I'm regretfully going to have to cut off Zivi here because we do have two more wonderful speakers. If people do have questions, please do send them on to, I'm Joe Pateski, but Karen Chan is the host for the meeting, so send those on to that screen name, and I'll capture those and see what we can do. Let me just slide this over to Carly.
Do I need to do anything to relinquish control?
I think I just grabbed the bowl, right? Can I do that?
Oh, I'm not. Looks like it.
Okay. All right. And then if I do this, can you stop saying things?
So while Carly's getting things set up, let me tell you about her. Dr. Carly Howitt is a senior research scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. She obtained her PhD at the University of Oxford in 2005 and since then has been working on the Cassini project. She was recently promoted to a co-investigator on Cassini's composite infrared spectrometer, which we know as SIRS. She helped plan the SIRS observations of icy satellites and recently helped negotiate the observing time of the last few years of Cassini observations. She specializes in understanding the surface characteristics of Saturn's icy satellites using infrared data. Carly, it's all yours.
Thanks. And can you see my screen? Can you hear me? Or is everything looking good?
Yep.
All right. So this is kind of a summary of the observations and the, like Libby presented, the results that have come out in the last year. So not all of necessarily the observations are taken in the last year, but kind of the analysis has been done in the last year. And for IC satellite, this is particularly a pertinent point because Cassini has ramped up in inclination, which has been great if you're interested in looking at the rings from a certain vantage point, or if you're interested in looking at the poles of Saturn. If you're interested in the IC satellites, it's a bit of a downer because instead of being in that plane that the IC satellites reside in, so you might get a couple of flybys every now and then, you really only get them very, very occasionally, and then they're very fast flybys because we're sort of coming down past the satellites. So we haven't had that many observations in the last year. There's been a, sort of a big push to really analyze the data we had before, and we're about to really start. We've just begun, really, that process of getting a lot more data as Cassini's moved down in inclination and we're back in the ring plane. So just to kick things off, this image I'm sure many people are familiar with, I think it's one of the most spectacular ones of the IC satellites that Cassini has taken. So you're looking at the southern pole of Enceladus, and you can see these kind of glorious jets that are coming out from the southern pole. And we're going to talk a lot about how they are made and how they're formed during this talk. It's an area of very much active research, if you pardon the pun. So just by way of an introduction, this is the ring and the satellite system. So you can see that the majority of the dense rings are very close to Saturn when you think of it in terms of the IC satellites, but rather Enceladus gives out all this dust and it creates this E-ring and ice and it creates this E-ring. And most of the larger IC satellites reside in this. I'm not going to focus too much on some of the smaller ones. We will touch Hyperion, but there's only so many minutes, so I have to share nicely. So I'm going to focus on the larger ones, so Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, and Rhea, and then Hyperion, so moving out from Saturn. All right, so with that orientation, let's dive in. So this is an image of Mimas that wasn't taken this year, but it's one of the closest ones we have. And if you look at the surface of this satellite, it looks quite boring in many ways, especially compared to the excitement that's going on at Titan. It's gray, it's heavily cratered. You can see there's a large crater at mid-latitudes called Herschel. But when you look in the visible, you don't really see a whole lot going on. But when you start looking in the infrared or you start looking in the UV, or in the thermal, we know that there's a lot more going on Mimas. And that was one of the big discoveries kind of early on. About 5 years ago, we discovered that Mimas actually surface has a big thermal anomaly on it. And so we haven't been able to get back to do any more research on that. We haven't had very good observations at high spatial resolution of Mimas. But what we have done is kind of continue to look at this satellite as it moves around Saturn. And what happens when the orbit of Mimas isn't circular, and that's very, very common. Instead, it kind of is slightly stretched out, it's elongated. And this slight deviation means that not that exactly the same point of Mimas is facing Saturn as it moves around in its orbit, and it wobbles slightly. And the Moon does this for the Earth too, and it's called a libration. That's the technical term for it. And by studying the libration, you can understand what's going on in Mimas's surface. Now, if you look at this, you don't see those active geysers and things like you do on Enceladus. It doesn't look geologically active. But what gravity studies have shown, is that this wobble doesn't quite make sense. And there's two possible options to explain the way that Mimas is wobbling, one of which is the center of it, the core of it, when it froze out, didn't freeze as a sphere. Rather, it froze out in kind of an American football shape or like a rugby ball shape if you're from the other side of the pond. And that would be pretty weird because usually these things are spinning as they cool, and we all know that if you take something and spin it, it doesn't usually end up in a rugby ball. Another option is that there's still a liquid water ocean under Mimas, and that's very exciting, but it's A, very unlikely perhaps, and B, it's difficult to imagine that because if you look at the surface, there's no evidence for geologic activity, and that would come in order for it to be warm enough to have a liquid ocean. This is a very small target. You'd expect to see lots more, fewer craters, maybe sort of signs of geology on its surface, and we don't see anything like that. So this is going to be something that people kind of continue. This is a relatively new result, and it's potentially quite an exciting one because if there is liquid water, that opens up a whole new world of research for Mimas, but it's perhaps on the optimistic side. All right, so moving on to my famous Moon. This is Enceladus. These are just two I think, fantastic images of the surface. So all of Enceladus's activity we know is constrained to the southern hemisphere. There's a lot of work that's going into understanding that. It's one of the most stable points. If something's rotating and there's a bit of Enceladus that's kind of heavier, it naturally moves to that kind of location of rotation, if you like, so that would naturally move to the poles. And so there's evidence for sort of shell rotation. So just to back up a bit, these are icy satellites. Their surface is water ice. And we think that there might be, in the past, there would have been a liquid ocean underneath it because the space is so cold, it freezes at the top but can remain liquid underneath, much like lakes on the Earth. And that kind of gives it a lubricant to be able to move around. So it's possible that the whole shell can kind of move around. But we see all of the activity on Enceladus at the southern poles. And this is only something you'd be able to see from Cassini because in order to get this sort of resolution, you're a long way from the Earth. And you're looking at it in very specific ways. We're looking at the southern hemisphere, which is hard to see from the Earth because we're all kind of in the same plane. And it also shows up really well if you look at scattered light, forward scattered light. So you have to have the right geometry. You basically have to have the sun, your spacecraft, and Enceladus in the right way in order to really see these plumes. So it's something we'd only have ever really seen with a spacecraft like Cassini. So one idea is that these geysers, the individual geysers, we call them discrete jets. And so this was an idea put forward by Carolyn Porco earlier in the year, and her and her team, she's the PI of the imaging team on Cassini, and her and her team looked at all of the images that ISS had taken, the camera had taken of these jets, and basically tried to figure out, okay, in this one we see a jet going here, a jet going here, and a jet going here, and then like kind of trying to bring that back and say, okay, where must they be located on the surface? And when you did that, they decided that they found that there was about 100 sources, and that's what's depicted in these pictures. Now, ignore the color. That's just so you can see, you know, which one's which. But you can see that the jets themselves come off at all these kind of really crazy angles. Some of them are very low to they're almost sort of tilted along the surface. Most go straight up, but some are sort of tilted either which way from that. All of them are located along the tiger stripes. These are the very warm regions. We see that when we look at thermal data, which is what I'm primarily interested in. They're all located along these tiger stripes. Now, there's another way of thinking about these geysers, which is has been recently put forward by Joe Spitali. And that's instead of thinking of these things as discrete jets, you could think of them as almost a continuum along these tiger stripe fractures. And that actually, when you look at discrete jets, what you're actually seeing is an optical illusion. You're seeing that the tiger stripes you can see from the top image aren't straight. They kind of wiggle around and wiggle around. And maybe if you're looking down the line, what you're actually thinking is a discrete jet isn't. Instead, you're just seeing kind of the effect of a bend in the tiger stripe. And this is, on the bottom, there's an illustration. So this is the image I showed earlier. The brightness has been enhanced. You can kind of see that the limb is quite washed out. But to really pull out the scattered dust away from the limb. And when you model them as discrete jets, you end up, on the right-hand side is computer animation, basically, a computer model. And you can recreate these images very well. Now, this there's definitely people in both camps. These are very new areas of research. And so it could be that it's six, you know, it's a little bit of one, it's a little bit of the other. Which is kind of where I think I lie, the idea that it makes sense to me that this whole area is emitting, but that some regions maybe are more active than others. But there's a really nice movie that I want to just take a moment to show you that was around these jets, and I think it really shows this kind of optical illusion effect a little more. So this was a movie that JPL put out around the same time as Joe Spitali's paper came out, and it kind of just shows you how you can how this optical illusion might work. And so here we go. So this is the image that we showed before, and then this is that computer model that I alluded to. And you can really get a sense, I think, once it starts curving around, what you're actually seeing is that sort of bend in the tiger stripe, and it's causing you to think that there's an increase in the emission, but it could be more just to do with the geometry of the observation. So, of course, it's colored green just to make it easy to see. All of the emission is water, so it's very unlikely to be green. We know it's actually very good at scattering the light, so we see it as a kind of increase in brightness. And then this, I think, is the end of it, just going back to that original image. So this is a continuing area of research. We're hoping that other observations, maybe from SEERs, looking at the thermal distribution at high spatial resolutions, that's something we have been struggling to do with our data set right now, or maybe with other observations, both UVIS, which is the UV spectrometer, and VIMS, which is the visual and infrared spectrometer, have observations of this region as an occultation. And what that means is that basically you look at a star move behind the target, and it's a very powerful observation type, because it allows you to basically get very high spatial resolution information on how the density of the atmosphere or those jets is changing. And so by combining all of these data sets from all of these other instruments, we'll be able to build on the sort of the power that gives you in order to kind of resolve these differences or issues, or maybe it's one, maybe it's the other, maybe it's a bit of both. Okay, moving on, but staying with Enceladus, there was a more gravity results. So we'd always suspected that there must be a liquid water ocean underneath Enceladus. And when you look at the plumes, so Cassini has actually flown through some of the plumes and sort of tasted them. And when you look at that result, when you look at what Cassini has seen in the plumes, there's strong evidence to think that some of the water must have been in contact with a rocky core underneath. So we've had for a long time, there's been kind of building evidence that there's at least a liquid water sea underneath Enceladus's active region. And Cassini has taken a lot of measurements very close to the surface of Enceladus in order to measure its gravity. And those measurements are complicated to combine, and the models are, you know, to really understand what's going on in an interior just by flying by it. The changes that the spacecraft feels from the gravity are very subtle, and so it's a complicated process to pull this out. But they've recently combined all these results and shown, provided more evidence that the layering of Enceladus is such that we have an outer shell, which is an icy, a cold ice shell, water ice shell, and underneath that, there's a regional ocean. They were showing. We were also, one of the possibilities was for a global ocean. That's not been completely ruled out, but there's stronger evidence to think that it's an ocean at high southern latitudes. That's what's shown in this picture. And then a low density rocky core. So this is kind of just adding to that dialogue about what could be going on in Enceladus's interior. And it's a hard thing to do when you're only able to fly by. We're not able to land, we're not able to sort of sample it in situ. You have to kind of come up with these very clever ways of understanding what's going on inside using these clever techniques. And in this case, basically they're looking at how the spacecraft is perturbed by Enceladus. So when it flies by, what's the pull of Enceladus on the spacecraft? Okay, so sort of staying with Enceladus but moving a little bit further out, and I hope I'm not jumping on Matt's toes too much by showing this. This quite complicated plot is basically looking at the effect Enceladus has on the region. So we talked about the plumes coming out of Enceladus, and they have to go somewhere. That mass just doesn't, you know, magically disappear. And what we find is Enceladus moves around its orbit. It kind of dumps these ice particles, these dust particles into space. And so in figure A, this one here, and the one beneath it in C, that's what you're seeing. This bright spot in the middle is Enceladus, and then this is kind of the kind of bright arc either side of it is the E-ring. So this is the ring of Saturn that's sustained by Enceladus. And there was a lot of puzzling for a long time, because this ring isn't just a nice simple ring. There's actually a lot of structure in these rings. And those are known as tendrils. You can see kind of pulling off here and pulling off here. And understanding what those tendrils really, really meant was a subject that we've been looking at for some time. And some work by the ISS team has gone on to model these. So what you're looking at on the right-hand side, oops, let's see if I can do these, is basically a model simulation now. So given the geometry of Enceladus, each of these particular epochs, they've used their model to see if they could recreate these structures. And you can see that there's a very close similarity between this computer model, so between C and D, and then between A and B. And what they did was take 36 of these most active geysers on Enceladus, and then they looked at when in the orbit they were, and then using information about the electromagnetic effects associated with the electrical charges that you can get on small grains, they can map the trajectories of these grains based on that modified, based on the effect that the Saturn magnetosphere will have on those grains. And these grains are very sensitive to particle size, so the smaller something is, the easier it is to perturb it. And so by doing this modeling, they showed that the grains in the E-ring were about half a micron. And for reference, a micron is a millionth of a meter. So these grains are very, very small. But that's a consistent size with the particles found in other Cassini observations. So perhaps the mystery of the tendrils is somewhat been resolved thanks to this work. Okay, so we're continuing out. And this is an observation that was taken of Tethys in May of this year. You can see it's a reasonably distant observation, and we're just getting the sunlit crescent. So this is giving you a sort of taste of the observations that we're starting to get. Our spatial resolution is getting much better as we're getting back into the plane, and we're starting to get sort of more targeted and close flybys of the IC satellite. One of the ongoing questions for IC satellite science is how much the surface varies not only across individual targets, but also within the sort of system. So how does MIMAS compare to Tethys? And you can see this is a great example of the variation that you see on one satellite alone. On the corner, that sort of cutout that's in, is a big crater called Odysseus. And when you look in the visible light, you can see that it really is very different, that the coloration of this area is very, very different to the rest of the surface. And when you see coloration differences, it's automatically telling you that there's something different about that. And it could be composition, it could be phase, it could just be the way, the sort of compaction and the porosity of the surface. But this is a really nice illustration that this is even though it's a geologically dead world, it's still a complicated world. And all of the observations that are taken this year will kind of go into understanding how that surface variation changes. All right, staying with Tethys, this was a result that was published in a press release this year by Paul Schenk and colleagues. And this is still on Tethys, and it's a false color image, but it's been stretched a little bit. But the thing that really jumps out are these red streaks that go across the surface of Tethys. And we have no idea, basically, what's going on here. That you see them across large swaths of Tethys' surface. They don't seem to be correlated with anything else. They don't seem to be particularly correlated with, say, a hemisphere on Tethys. We see them kind of dotted around various hemispheres. They don't seem to be correlated with activity. We don't see an increase in the thermal emission at these regions. They seem to be geologically young. They cut across older features that you can see in this image. They kind of cut across these crater features. And they appear to be quite narrow and quite thin. They're not constrained to the equator, so we don't think it was sort of a ring that might have collapsed. And we don't really have a good feeling of why this is happening and what's going on with Tethys. So one of the great things about having Cassini still going is you can say with new science, you can say, hey, we've seen this. This is kind of weird. We don't understand it. Is there any chance we can get some more time? And the Cassini project were great, and they responded to this sort of begging plea earlier this year, and they switched an observation. And these observations are going to be taken in November, and so that observation package was all kind of neatly tied up, actually. It kind of almost had a bow around it. But the Cassini project was so excited about this new result that they sort of undid the bow and dove in, and various people gave up their observation time so that we could add in an additional 2 hours to have. There was a particular time in Cassini's orbit where it was a really good opportunity to go back and have a look at this area. And so Cassini gave us that time, and we will be looking at it again in November. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have more data on the ground, so we'll be able to kind of understand what these mysterious streaks are actually telling us. Okay. Cassini, as it was kind of mentioned, is still doing great, but some of the targeted flybys are now coming to an end. We're starting to see the beginning of the last X, the last Y, and Dione was a particularly poignant one, I think, this year for Cassini. We had our last targeted flyby of Dione. We didn't actually have one, we had two. So each one is given a number, and this was D4 and D5. So this is the fifth one was the last targeted flyby of Dione that we'll have. They occurred in June and August of this year, and these are two images that were taken with this data set. The data is basically so new, it's beginning of August, that other than some initial analysis, which myself and colleagues have done, we don't have any kind of papers or results on these yet. But I think they're, the images themselves speak volumes as to the quality of the data that we're going to get down. So you can see on the left-hand side, Dione is sitting on a backdrop of the rings. This was taken on June 16th, and we got down to about 300 miles above the surface, which is pretty darn close. You can see Dione has this kind of strange wispy terrain, which is basically these bright white ice cliffs, and you're seeing a little bit of that on the bottom of the image. And then as you get towards the terminator, so when it moves from day-night, you can really pick out lots of the crazy topography that Dione has. Again, Dione's, we think it's geologically dead. There is a chance for activity on Dione. There's been some hints, some whiffs, but nothing concrete. But there's certainly large areas that are heavily cratered on Dione, and you can really get a sense of what a complex place or what a complex surface it is in order to understand it. We don't have any pesky atmosphere, so to that end, it's a little bit easier than Titan, but it is a complicated world. The other image to the right was taken actually just before the closest approach. You can see a number of bright craters. We have some bright ray craters on Dione. And on Tethys, we've seen that they're often correlated with an increase in the thermal inertia, which means they're less porous, so that material, that ejector, has a different, it's the same composition, but it's a different makeup. It's kind of more compacted than the rest of the surface. And so we'll be using this these observations in order to understand whether the same thing's occurring on Dione, or whether the nature of the impact or the effect of the impact is different on Dione. And again, you're looking at Dione, it's a little bit hard to see, with a backdrop of Saturn, and then this line here is the rings and the shadow on Saturn. So just for completion, I feel like you couldn't do a tour of the Saturn system without mentioning Rhea. We didn't actually have any targeted flybys, but we have a lot of observations of Rhea. And this was just an image that I thought was pretty. So what you can see here is the stark contrast of Rhea's limb against the dark night sky. And you can see how bumpy it is. If it was a smooth surface, you'd expect to see a sort of very uniform limb, but instead you're seeing kind of the edge of craters and rivets and things like that. And so, again, this just feeds into that dialogue of these each of these targets being very complicated in their own right, but making comparisons between them is very important. Again, this was taken earlier in February. All of these data sets are still being combined and analyzed. So I think by the time we get to DPS, which is a big conference in November, a big planetary science conference, there'll be a lot of neat results on this, but it's a bit too early to talk to at least at any length about the new results. If this was geologically active, so like you see on Titan, like you see on the Earth, all of these craters would have been somewhat eroded, or at least they wouldn't be as sort of pristine as we see them on Rhea. Okay, so the final topic is Hyperion, and this, by comparison, just looks absolutely bonkers. We've had some great images of Hyperion in the past. This one was taken this year. We had a sort of long campaign to look at Hyperion, actually. It went on, I think, for a few days as we ended up kind of near enough to it in order to observe it. This one was taken at the end of May. Now, Hyperion is a bit of a strange one in that it rotates chaotically, and what that means is it kind of tumbles through space. So most of the satellites will have the same face of their satellite facing Saturn the whole time. A bit like we only see this, you know, one side of the moon as we rotate and it rotates around us. So it's a very stable configuration. And so most satellite systems end up in that configuration. But Hyperion is kind of weird, and it's weird shaped and it's very small. And so it doesn't obey the same rules, if you like, and it kind of tumbles around Saturn. We've really only been able to image one of the hemispheres. Whenever we go by it, for various reasons, we end up looking at the same hemisphere. And so this is similar to the observation we saw before. But you can see that it has this kind of crazy structure. There's two things that are going on here. One is it has very, very low density. It's about half that of water, which has two effects. One is it means it's porous and it has a weak surface gravity. So what happens is when you get something that's impacting it, so you have something that's going to slam into the surface, what happens is it compresses the surface. So you end up with like little divots, a bit like dropping pennies in the sand. It kind of burrows down rather than sort of blows out. And any material that does come out, instead of kind of coming back onto the surface and recoating the surface, the gravity here is so low, it just blows away. And so you end up with kind of a surface that has all these sort of little pockets that are almost like, you know, pennies in the sand or dust grains sort of hitting the surface. It's a very strange place. It's hard to see. This is a black and white image, but if you earlier observations showed that it was quite red, and the red color, one of the ideas was that the red coloration was coming from one of its neighboring satellites. We don't know if that's really true, but it makes it a very complicated and interesting place. And so I think that's all I have, other than saying there's some really great links. Always keep an eye on the RAW site. Cassini puts out its images very quickly. They're not calibrated, so they're difficult to do science with. But to sort of see what Cassini's been seeing, they're a great resource. And that's the link to that, which I think it's easy if you can Google that and come up with the same answer. And there's also a really nice feature that I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to, but I kind of wanted to – oh, is this going to work? Here we go. Can you see this? Does this?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what this is showing is basically it's a slider that moves between Voyager and Cassini map. So if I slide it all the way to the right, this is the map that was returned by the analysis of Voyager data. And if we slide it over, this is the best map that we have right now, a complete map of MIMAS. And so you can play with this. And I think, I mean, I'm a big fan of Enceladus, but you can really see how Cassini really filled in the gap with Enceladus. This was the reason that we had no idea what the activity on Enceladus was, because all of this southern hemisphere region, all the region down here, was just not mapped at all by Voyager. And you can kind of get a sense of just what a great job, just by looking, this is the Odysseus crater that we saw on the edge, that limb of Tethys, and you can see how much more clear it is in Tethys. You can also really get a sense of how the coloration variation changes across the satellites. For example, the blue streaks that you can see on on Enceladus, and then this lens-shaped feature that you see on Tethys that's also correlated with a thermally anomalous region. These wispy terrains on Dione, this is what we were alluding to before. There was various ideas about what these could be. Basically, there was sort of geological activity. That was the big idea. When Cassini got there, it really did show that these areas are quite discrete. But rather than something crazy, you're basically looking at bright white ice cliffs down the side of Dione. And so you can play around this. We didn't really talk about Iapetus. We haven't had many more observations of Iapetus. But Cassini really did show the stark contrast between the different hemispheres that was alluded to in Voyager data, but really made very clear in Iapetus. And understanding this shape has enabled us to have a much better understanding of what caused it. And those results have been, that's still a matter for discussion, but it's a lot more satisfying to try and fit real observations then, without gaps in. So it's been great. So that's a lot of fun, and I encourage everyone to go on and have a bit of a play with that. I think that came out earlier last year, yeah, but it's great. So I think with that, if we have time, I'll go back and take questions.
I think we have time for a couple of questions. Anybody online?
Can you talk a little bit about the coloration that we just saw on the previous slide?
On this slide?
Mm-hmm.
On this? Yeah. Like most missions, don't have a full spectrum of coloration, right? So the color cameras on Cassini are the same as that. So we have discrete filters, and often one of the things you can do then is you ratio them. So when we look at color, one of the things you have to think about is whether it's true color, and true color means how your eye would perceive something, or whether it's false color, which means you kind of have these bands and you've stretched them in order to pick things out. And one of the things that you can see that jumps out, and let's just start with MIMAS, is this kind of blue lens. And And this really is actually more UV than blue. It's a blue ring. I mean, the UV is on the same side of the spectrum. But you wouldn't get that if you just looked at it with your eyes. You wouldn't be able to see this. So it's kind of an exaggerated view. And what we've found is that there's a correlation in this coloration between the color and what we see in the thermal data. And so by combining those things, and we've found that the surface here is being modified. It's better able to reflect UV light, but it's also more able to store and release heat during the day. And when you look at things like where the high energy electrons bombard, it's in this blue region. It's around this area here. And so the coloration is very important as it forms like part of the surface story. In order to get coloration variations, like I said, you have to have, there has to be something different about that surface, and there's various things that could be. It could be it's better able to, for some reason, for the surface has been modified, so it's better able to reflect light or absorb light at different wavelengths. It could be that the composition is different, and so we know that, say, the sand and water look different, and that's because the composition is different. But sand and water also, water and ice also look different because there's a phase change, because that gives the material a different property. And so I think it's a really good diagnostic tool to look at these colors and figure out what's going on. You see the same thing in Enceladus. Enceladus is a lot more blue here. And we know that's because, we think that's because the particle sizes are just different. The southern pole, the particle sizes are smaller, I think, which is better able to reflect blue light. And so it's in itself, it can be a great diagnostic tool for figuring out, okay, this area is different to this area, why? And that's where the rest of Cassini really comes in, the other instruments, because together they can kind of go ahead and start understanding and giving those answers.
And the darker patch on Tethys there, is that in the direction of travel in its orbit?
So this is the leading hemisphere. It's a bit hot every time I move the point. So the right-hand lens is the leading hemisphere. The darker bit is the trailing hemisphere. And that's a pattern you see throughout the solar system, actually. You can see the same thing on Dione. It's a bit more subtle if I move this over, but you can see the same thing on Rhea as well.
So it's trailing.
And so what's actually happening is, part of it is Enceladus is just like sending out all this stuff into the universe, and it's bright white ice. And so the leading hemisphere of anything outwards of Enceladus, so Tethys, Dione, Rhea, this leading hemisphere, the right-hand hemisphere, is impacting that that bright white ice, and it's being coated by it. And so it's actually more, you could think of it more of a brightening of the leading hemisphere rather than a darkening of the trailing hemisphere.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm going to reluctantly leave off from icy satellites at this point. Thank you very much, Carly. If people do have questions, I will see about if we can take questions and possibly publish answers on the charm page in the future. We apologize if there's some rumbling noise coming through the speakers. We're having construction here at JPL and hoping it's not going to disturb the online experience as much as it is disturbing us. So thank you very much, Carly. And let me hand this off to Matt, who is our final speaker for the day. Matt, you online?
Yep.
Okay, so while you're getting set up, Dr. Matt Tiscarino, who has just relocated to the SETI Institute in Northern California, studies Saturn's rings as an associate of the Cassini imaging team. He's an expert on the waves that propagate throughout the rings and on the regularly shaped scalloped edges of ring gaps, which he uses to infer properties of the disk and the bodies that perturb it. He led the discovery of hundreds of small moonlets embedded in the rings, seen indirectly by the propeller-shaped disturbances they create in the surrounding ring material. Drawing on the analogy between moonlets embedded in Saturn's rings and protoplanets embedded in the disk of our early solar system, Dr. Tiscarino is currently studying in more detail the propeller-shaped structure to learn about the underlying disk-moonlet interactions, and is tracking the propellers through time to study their orbital evolution. So just as we just saw a lot of great photos from icy satellites, because the spacecraft was orbiting in the essentially around the equator of the planet, so we got lots of great views, what was a great pictorial year for the icy satellites was not so much for the rings, and that's going to be changing in the next couple of years as we move the spacecraft out of the equatorial plane and into high elevations. So with that introduction, it's up to you, Matt.
Hi, thank you, Jill. Yes, as Joe just said, here is a profile in the RINC community. We care about the inclination of the spacecraft quite a lot, so here is the inclination. Here's my cursor. So we had a really great several years of this period of high inclination where we were looking down on the face of the rings and were able to get a lot of great observations. The past year, we've been coming down off of that and wrapped up that inclined period. We're now in the equatorial region again, so Carly is happy and we are not so much, but the pendulum will swing back again. Over here, we will start ramping up in 2016. The inclination will get higher and higher, and then up here, we will have the grand finale, which will be not only at high inclination, where we have great viewing geometry, but then diving down very close to the rings. We'll start to get some of these resolutions that the satellite people take for granted, where you actually fly quite close to your target, which, you know, Cassini flew quite close to the rings in the orbit insertion maneuver back in 2004 and really hasn't since then. So we look at things like a kilometer per pixel as some of the best resolutions we've gotten during the main part of the mission. We're going to get down to, you know, several hundred meters per pixel, which we're really excited about. Some of the highlights that I'm going to discuss in this talk, we'll update you on a systematic search for spiral waves that I've been doing, and I'm going to put together a few people's observations and talk about some new puzzles regarding the mass of the rings. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Maxwell Ringlet project that Dick French is finishing up, and then as Joe already has given a bit of an introduction on the propellers project, and I'll update you on those. So spiral density waves are a pervasive structure, especially in the outer part of the rings. They are excited by moons, mostly orbiting further from Saturn than the rings, although a few of them are actually orbiting within the rings. I should modify this slide because some of these waves are actually excited by structure within the planet that's rotating with the planet and then exciting these structures in the rings. These are all resonance structures. So at any location, for example, let's see, this one here is where a ring particle is orbiting Saturn exactly five times every time that Mimas orbits three times. And so what that means is that whenever Mimas passes by a particular ring particle, the ring particle is at the same part of its orbit as it was the last time. And so then the pushes add up, just like when you're pushing your child on a swing at the playground. If you time the pushes properly, the pushes add up and the child goes higher and higher. Same with these. The Mimas' pushes add up on top of each other, and so then the ring particle develops a deviation from its circular orbit, which then causes a wave to propagate through the ring because the ring particles are close enough together that their gravity affects each other. This is the same fundamental process that creates the spiral arms in galaxies that you see over here. The main difference is that galaxy spirals are much more loosely wound. The spiral hasn't even gone all the way around the galaxy and already at the outer edge, whereas the spiral arms in Saturn's rings are very tightly wound. This spiral arm here, for example, goes all the way around the planet. This is a four-arm spiral, so one, two, three, four. This one here is the same arm as this one, having gone all the way around the planet, and it's only a few hundred kilometers further from Saturn's center. So these are tightly wound spirals. And one of the interesting things about this is that although the theory for spiral density waves was originally developed for galaxies, there's still a lot of discussion in the galaxy community as to how and even whether that theory really does describe the spiral arms of galaxies. However, that same theory has been used for Saturn's rings, and it works exquisitely well, and we have confirmed it in exceedingly great detail. And in fact, what we now have the theory nailed down so well that we can use these waves as scientific instruments that are embedded in the rings. And at each location where we see one of these waves, we can measure the parameters of that wave and then learn about the rings at that location and their properties, and also the properties of whatever it is that is exciting the wave. Here is this picture here in the middle is a close-up picture. It's kind of grainy because this is from the orbit insertion, those highest resolution images that we've gotten. The exposures were low because people were worried about smear because the spacecraft was moving so fast. But this is a high-resolution picture. And what we've done here, and I'll be doing this a number of times in the talk, is you take everywhere that's all the pixels that are at a single distance from Saturn. So basically you take circles in the rings and add them up. So here, along here, you have all the pixels that are at a certain distance from Saturn. You add them up, and then up here you have a radial scan that you add up. So you can see that I've kind of lined this up. So the troughs of this radial scan line up with the dark lines across the image. And what you can then do is take the different parameters of the wave. So here, the wavelength dispersion of the wave, you can see the wavelength actually changes as you go downstream. The wavelength gets smaller and smaller. But by measuring that wavelength and how it changes, that tells you the surface density, how much material there is in the disk at that location. By looking here at where the wave begins, that tells you exactly where the resonance is. That then tells you what is the orbital speed of whatever it is that's exciting the wave, whether it's a moon or whether it's a mode inside the planet. You also notice that the amplitude of the wave increases for a while, and then it turns around and starts decreasing again. The distance to the point where the amplitude starts to decrease again gives you a damping parameter, and that also tells you something about the viscosity of the rings at this location, how much the ring particles are rubbing against each other and dissipating energy, which again is an important property that you want to map as many locations through the rings as you can. Then you have the amplitude, which just directly tells you the mass of the moon or the mode in the planet that is exciting the ring. And then you also have a phase parameter, which tells you something about where the perturbing object is with relation to where you are in the rings. So we use this theory to analyze these waves and to learn about the disk. Here's now an image that was taken not quite so close up, but with a more stable exposure. Stable camera was able to integrate a bit longer and get really nice signal to noise. This is one of the best, highest fidelity images that we have, at least for images that cover the entire radial range of the rings. We have images like this going the entire radial range of the rings. And so what you see if you look at this image, you see some very clear waves. This is the same wave that I showed at the beginning. Actually, the mean is 5 to 3 wave that I showed at the beginning is a little bit higher up, off the top of this slide. This is the 5 to 3 bending wave. Now, there's a slightly different frequency for the in and out motion of ring particles and the up and down motion of ring particles. So the bending wave is where Mimas is exciting the up and down motion of ring particles. Mimas is actually on an eccentric orbit by a couple degrees and is able to excite these vertical motions as well as in and out motions. And the bending waves, it turns out, propagate inward. And so you see them kind of in contrast to most of the waves which propagate outward. So you see this clear Mimas 5 to 3 bending wave here. This is a Prometheus 12 to 11 density wave propagating outward. And then you see a bunch of other structure. It looks kind of like record grooves for those of you who are old enough to remember vinyl records. And just looking at the image, it's not really clear what all of this structure is and how we can make sense of it. But it turns out that if we take a radial scan, so here then is that same image that I just showed before. Here now we've taken a radial scan of that image. You can see each of these little record grooves here, here, and here. Here's that jumbled structure in between the two waves. That's this structure right here. Now we can take another step and do what's called wavelet analysis. What we do here is we take a spectrogram, basically. We take the different frequencies. You can see, for example, that this wave right here, there are lower frequencies. The wave crests are farther apart. Up here, the frequencies are higher. The wave crests are closer together. And so down here, if you follow this down into the wavelet transform, you see there's power. The darker shades are where there's power in the frequency spectrum. You have the lower wavelength, the longer wavelength, the lower frequencies have more power here. Whereas over here, where you have higher frequencies, it's the higher frequencies up here that have power. And you can then fit model. So each of the dashed lines here is a model of what a particular resonance that we can identify ought to be doing. And if you look carefully at how these dashed lines follow very closely the patterns of grayscale in this wavelet analysis, what we've done here is we are making sense of each of these little squiggles. And it turned out that this jumbled record grooves here in between the two waves turned out to be several waves. Here's a pan 46 to 45 wave. Here's a pan 47 to 46 wave. And then in between them, then we have a Pandora 19 to 17 wave and so forth. So we can map out all of these resonances and each of these little bumps and wiggles in the ring. This is kind of mapping out the geography of the ring. This is like the craters and the valleys and the different things that you see on the surfaces of a satellite. This is how we map out the geography of the rings. And understanding the structure that we see in this basically disk. So moving on then, here's another location in the rings, and if you'll notice up in the top corner of each of these view graphs, I've given you a bit of an orientation. Here's a cross-section of the rings, and I have this little diamond showing where in the rings we are. So back here, go up. Okay, yeah, so up here we're in the middle A-ring. Here we're still in the middle A-ring. We see some more waves, and I'm not going to wade too much through the details, although these are the kind of details that I really like. Here, this black dashed line is a signature that we don't understand. Now, there are some parts of the rings where just about all the structure is stuff that we don't understand, but in the outer A-ring, it's actually unusual to find structure that we don't understand, and that really is structure that we ought to be able to understand. So this little dashed line here is a puzzle that dynamical analysis can try to figure out. And again, the slopes of each of these lines give you the surface density. So we can then map out the surface density, and it turns out that the A-ring gives about 35 grams for every square centimeter of disk through most of the A-ring, but in the outer A-ring, that density tails down and gets down to only 15, so less than half of what it is in the major part of the A-ring, which is weird because this part of the A-ring is actually the brightest part. And I'm going to return to this theme later. It has long been assumed that if you see the ring look brighter, if you see the ring look like it's blocking more starlight, if you're watching a star shine through the ring, then that means that there's more stuff there. And in a number of places, we're finding the opposite to actually be true. Here, with these density waves, we are directly measuring the mass instead of assuming a correlation between how much brightness we see and how much stuff is there. And we actually find that although the ring is brighter over here, there's actually less stuff there. So I'm going to return to that. But we also see in the inner part of the A-ring, we have one big long wave that I'm going to show you in a few slides that's given us this profile for the whole inner A-ring and as it blends into the Cassini division. The outer part of the Cassini division we call the ramp, because we see the surface density ramping up from only a couple grams per square centimeter down in the main part of the Cassini division, ramping up here, and then getting up to the A-ring where it's about 35. So a little bit more about how we analyze these density waves. Maybe I should go a little more quickly through this, but at each place, this is now an iapetus wave. Iapetus is much farther from the rings. And so what we actually have is iapetus goes around Saturn so slowly that the ring particles are whipping around really fast. And the plane of the ring particle orbit is precessing around Saturn, just like you see a top. You know, the axis of a top precesses. If you spin it, the top itself is spinning very fast. And then you see the axis of the top make a circular motion much more slowly. That precession motion for ring particles is here resonant with the orbit of iapetus, because iapetus is so far from Saturn, it's orbiting very slowly. This causes a very large wave that gives us several thousands of kilometers of real estate in the ring, telling us exactly what the surface density is. And I'm not going to go through this in a little bit of detail of how we measure it. I'm going to skip that. But we have a surprising result here from this iapetus wave. So this upper panel here is that surface density profile for about 4,000 kilometers of real estate. giving us the surface density from this iapetus wave. And here's where it's weird. This is the optical depth profile down here. This is basically how much light is reflected if you're looking on the lit face of the rings, or how much light is blocked if you're watching a star pass behind the rings. And there are two steps. This is the Cassini division here. This is that ramp where you see a little bit of ramping up for the A-ring. We see a big step in the optical depth here, and then a little bit of a doorstep here, and then another big step, and then you're up in the main part of the A-ring. Turns out that the second step does have a major step in the surface density also. There is more stuff up here in the main part of the A-ring and less down here. But here, where we see a big step in the optical depth, we see no step at all in the surface density. And this is really mystifying, because what this means is that you have the same amount of stuff on either side of this big step in optical depth. For some reason, the same amount of stuff blocks a whole lot more light, takes up a whole lot more space on either side of this boundary. And that the simplest explanation that remains to us is that the particle properties are changing at this location. Perhaps you have the same amount of stuff in larger particles up here. You have a larger mass for each bit of surface area, whereas over here, maybe it breaks up into smaller particles, and you have, for the same amount of stuff, you have more surface area so that it blocks more light. But why you would have a sharp boundary in surface and particle properties is a mystery, and we don't understand that yet. As I said here, and similar conclusions are now coming from other Cassini measurements, that we seem to have some big changes in particle properties, where previously we had assumed that these are changes in the amount of stuff that's there, but now that we're finding more methods of directly measuring the amount of stuff, directly measuring the mass, we're finding that it's about the same. So these must be these big changes in particle properties. I'm going to shift gears slightly, although this is still getting on the theme of the last slide. I believe Phil Nicholson and Matt Hedman gave a Charm Telecon a few months ago on this whole topic. So this is just going to briefly orient you on this new project of chronoseismology. So what this is doing is using these same spiral density waves that I was just describing to you, but a few of them we are observing in places where there is no resonance with a moon that we know of that would raise a wave. And it turns out that many of these waves can be correlated to frequencies that come from inside the planet. And if you have these different kinds of asymmetries in the planet that are rotating at different frequencies, they can raise waves in the rings just the same as a moon orbiting outside of the rings can do. And so Phil and Matt have been working on this and have started to use the rings basically as a detector, as a probe, to help us learn more about the internal structure of Saturn. A similar project that Dick French is leading and is just coming out in a journal is the Maxwell ringlet. Now, we're over here in the middle of the C ring here. This is a kind of exaggerated view of what the Maxwell ringlet looks like. This is an exaggerated simulation from Dick, and I put a little picture of Saturn in the middle. The Maxwell ringlet is an eccentric ringlet. It's orbiting in the middle of a gap in the C ring. There are some eccentric ringlets. There's one called the Titan ringlet because it's precessing at the same rate that Titan is going around Saturn. There's another one called the Huygens ringlet that has all kinds of different modes. There's a six-lobed pattern and various other patterns that seem to be interacting with Mimas and other things. The Maxwell ringlet seems to be a pretty pure eccentric shape, precessing at the rate that you would expect given how far from Saturn it is. But what Dick and his colleagues noticed is that there are some wave crests in the middle of the ring. So it's an eccentric ring. So here it's narrower where it's closer to Saturn, and it's wider where it's farther away from Saturn. So here's where it's closer to Saturn and narrower, and here's where it's farther from Saturn and it spreads out. And there are these wave crests here at periaps, where it's closest to Saturn. They look real spiky and close together. And as the ringlet moves away from Saturn towards its apoapsis, the wave crests spread apart like an accordion. And then as you move back towards the place where it's closest to Saturn, the wave crests actually here, they reverse. They become spiky gaps instead of spiky peaks. So I don't know that all the details of that are understood, although Dick and Johan and some others have done some simulations to understand this process, but one of their conclusions is that this turns out to be a two-armed spiral that is resonating with a period that is about twice Saturn's rotation period. So this turns out to be another one of these waves that fits in with Matt Hedman's chronoseismology. This is one of Matt Hedman's figures which Dick has modified to include the Maxwell wave. This down here is Saturn's rotation period, and as you may have heard from the magnetospheric talks, Saturn's rotation period changes and is different depending on how you measure it and when you measure it, and that's really weird. You see these different frequencies also reflected in the rings, and then up here you have twice the rotation period. So you can have resonances with twice the rotation period, and the max ringlet is then adding to that picture. So putting several of these themes together, we can ask how old are the rings? So there's the Iapetus minus 1 to 0 wave that I showed you, and there are other waves in the B and C ring, including some of these chronoseismal waves, that are giving densities that don't scale with how much light the rings are reflecting, which are telling us that maybe the rings are not as dense as we expected in the places where the rings reflect more light. At the same time, the SEERS project, and I don't have a lot of details on this, but the thermal infrared measurements of the B ring are indicating that the ring particles are fluffy in the B ring. They're lower density than we thought. Now, both of these things are challenging to what we thought about 5 years ago was a big bit of progress that we were making. It's been a long-standing mystery, how old are the rings? There's a certain amount of dust falling into the rings all the time, and yet the rings are very pristine water ice. And it turned out that there are some simulations indicating that you could hide a lot of mass in the B ring, and the B ring could be supermassive, several times the mass of Mimas, and that would make it easy to hide all of this infalling dust and let the rings be as old as Saturn, even though they seem quite pristine. But if the rings are not so massive, then that explanation is challenged. Both these direct measurements of the mass through the spiral wave and this indirect measurement that the ring particles in the beaming seem to be fluffy. Those are both challenging this conclusion that we thought was some progress. But to the rescue comes the Cassini Cosmic Dust Analyzer, which is starting to be able to measure, as it measures dust in the Saturn system, it's actually able to measure where the dust comes from. And a small number of the dust particles that it's measuring are actually coming from outside the Saturn system. And they now have good enough statistics to separate those out. And they're telling us that the interplanetary dust influx is smaller than previously thought. So if you combine this with the B-ring being not as massive as previously thought, we still might be able to have the B-ring stay pristine despite 4 billion years of infalling dust. Okay. Am I totally out of time, Joe? Should I just skip the propeller?
Well, you kind of got some time taken away from you, so I another 10 minutes, I think.
10 minutes.
You can
all right,
take
we can
5 minutes and give us 5 minutes for questions, because actually you have a bunch of people in the room at least who kind of have their mouths hanging open. So
okay. All right, 5 minutes. We can do propellers. All right. Propellers are movements that are embedded in the disk. This is a schematic of how the streamlines work. There's a movement here in the middle. The ring material around it gets disturbed, and you see this propeller-shaped structure. Here are some actual pictures of propellers, and I'll skip the details. Propellers are interesting in part because they are the first time in the history of astronomy that we have tracked an object as it is orbiting, embedded in a disk. We're tracking an object's orbit while it is embedded in a disk. Everything else in the solar system that we track the orbit of, everything that we know that's an exoplanet is orbiting in free space. But here we have the prospect of measuring how embedded objects interact with their disk. How does the disk affect the orbit of this embedded object? And that obviously has a lot of implications for how we understand protoplanetary disks, the history of our own solar system, as well as disks that we see around other stars. All right, so we see these orbits are, in fact, changing. We now have coming up on 10 years of data on some of these propellers. And we see them, this is basically with a long-term trend subtracted off. So we see it lagging behind the trend, moving ahead of the trend, lagging behind the trend again. So going back and forth, not a single direction of migration, but migration going back and forth. Several explanations for this have been proposed. Could it be resonances with the moons? That would predict a pure sinusoid. I think most of us are convinced that we're not seeing pure sinusoids, although one researcher in particular still wants to stick with that model. And there may be some situations where it's relevant. Could it be smooth interactions with the disk? That would lead us to expect curvature in these plots. I think we do see evidence of curvature, but we also see evidence of very sharp changes. Like here, for example, where you see curvature coming down here, and then all of a sudden, oops, all of a sudden we shoot off in this direction. Another researcher has proposed that everything here is stochastic. If it's the distance from Saturn that's moving basically randomly, you would expect these longitudes to be correlated with each other, and you would see things that look like trends, but they're really just shifting temporary trends, and you would never see something resolve to a long-term trend. My favorite model is number 4, that we actually do see smooth interactions with the disk that are punctuated by sudden changes. All right, and these are propellers, and so we have nicknamed them after aviation pioneers, and so I'm going to give you some updates on several of these propellers and what we see them doing. Santos Dumont, we see taking this, what I think is a curved trajectory over nearly 5 years, and then a change here, and then it's taking a more smooth evolution. We have Earhart here. We didn't have very good data on it at all. And I should mention briefly that what happened here in late 2012 is that we started to track these propellers a lot more often. We very intentionally said we want to, every time we can, every time there's a periapsis, if there isn't something else that needs to be happening, we want to at least check in on the propellers we already knew about. And so we've been doing that as much as we can, and so you can see dramatic improvement in how often we're checking on these orbits, and then we can start to piece out how they're changing. And so what I think I see with Earhart is we see a curved trajectory here, and then a kick, and then a curved trajectory in the other direction. Then we have POST, where, again, here where we the green is blown up down here, we have, I think, it looks like a straight trajectory here, and then a kick, and a straight trajectory here. So here's where we see something that's more episodic, whereas with Earhart, I think we saw something more gradual. And then the granddaddy of them all is Blériot, which this is what I was showing in the first slide, the whole trend coming down this way. Blériot then took a dramatic turn in the other direction. And it started to seem like the stochastic model was right, because it was predicting that whatever time scale you're looking at, you're going to see something that looks like an oscillation on that time scale, and that is kind of what you see here. But the most recent data, which I can't show because Joe said I shouldn't show anything that I haven't shown at a conference, is starting to see some curvature up here at the top end. So I think maybe my model can be rescued. But, of course, this is how science works. We may have our preferred models, but we all need to be open-minded and go wherever the data leads us. So that's the end of the talk. So just in conclusion, I'd like to remind people Saturn's ring system is an astrophysical disk that's accessible. It's not light years away. It's not billions of years in the past. We can visit it at close range. We can observe these phenomena that also operate in other kinds of disks and draw parallels. Rings also function as detectors. They can tell us about their environment, including, as I mentioned in this talk, the interior structure of Saturn. There's a lot that we understand. There's also a lot that we don't understand. And the more you get down into this data, you learn more, and then you just uncover more questions that you hadn't even thought to ask. So don't believe the simplicity of your models. Always be ready to be challenged and learn something new. So thank you.
Thank you, Matt. That was outstanding. Are there any questions online? Well, I like to say that it's very clear why you found your new home at SETI, and I was wondering if there are any specific avenues of investigation and collaboration that you're looking at working with people who are looking at exoplanets.
I haven't really gotten into that. I've barely been here a month, but that certainly is something that we will look into.
Matt, Dave Duty at JPL, tell us about what you're looking forward to investigating when we're in our proximal orbit phase?
Oh, it's going to be totally fantastic. I think the biggest thing is, and we're going to devote several orbits to this, is directly tracking the spacecraft from Earth as it swoops past the ring, and we will hopefully directly measure the mass of the rings. And I can't tell you how momentous that one number is if we can do it, and I think we're going to do it. But other things that we're going to do, especially so the proximal orbits are the ones where we're actually diving between the rings and the planet. And that's going to get us some great views of the C ring, and it's actually going to give us the best gravity mass measurement, and we're going to be directly measuring the ring atmosphere and things like that. But what I personally am most excited about is actually before we dive between the rings and the planet, where we're diving just off the outer edge of the rings, and that's where we're going to have the closest views of the A ring, which is the outermost part of the main rings. And the spiral waves and the propellers, they're all in the A-ring. The A-ring is heaviest in structure that we more or less understand. And so really being able to get into detail of something we already have a fair idea of what's going on, we are able to better formulate our questions and look exactly where we want to look to really get some high-resolution data. We're going to target some of these propellers I was just showing you, hopefully maybe even image the central movement and see a lot more detail of how the intricate inner parts of that disturbance forms itself. We're going to get a high-resolution scan that covers the entire radial extent of the rings at between half and three-quarters of a kilometer per pixel, which is now we know how to set the exposures, so we're going to get better signal to noise than we did in SOI. Lots of really great stuff.
Any other questions online? I want to thank all of our speakers again very much. Those were three outstanding presentations. Thanks to all who were able to join us. I'm hoping that we'll be able to have a recording of this with both the visual and the audio online in the next few weeks. Stay tuned for that. And then our next Charmed Telecon will be on Tuesday, October 27th. Look forward to joining all of you then. Thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.